I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the high-low, ladies and gentlemen. This is the weekly pop culture and news podcast inspired by Vanity Fair editors Tina Brown's ethos, which is all culture is best consumed in high and lowbrow quantities. I'm Dolly Alderton and this is Pandora Sykes. I told you I could do the intro well.
That was psychotic. You sounded really bizarre.
Pandora just commented before we started recording that I always freeze up when I do the intro.
You do, you freak out. It's about an hour.
Okay, later. Well, that's the last. We won't ever do it. You should always do the intro from now on.
No, because we'll get a complaint saying that I've overridden you.
Run roughshod over you. Welcome to the High Earth. This is your first ever episode. For everyone else, it's episode 19. Thanks for bearing with us. And thank you for letting us have a week off last week.
We know
it's hard. We are governed by our people.
We are. That is true. And millennials, as we know, are famously entitled when it comes to consuming free content. But we love you all the more for it.
It was all Pandora's fault because she was away on holiday. How was your holiday?
Very nice, thank you. I was away for 9 days and it was the perfect mix because I was in Norfolk with my family for 5 days for my mother's 70th.
And is that the reason for the trip?
Yeah.
Oh.
And a third of all meals were sausage plat. And
so funny, I just don't think of the Sykeses as a sausage plat family.
Oh my God, yeah, it's one of Mum's top three meals. Sausage plat, cauliflower cheese with ham, and chicken noodle soup.
And how does
and anyone in the family could name, if you were like, what are Mum's three meals?
Those are the three classics.
Yeah.
How does one serve a sausage plat?
It's sausage in a plat.
In a pastry plat. And then what does she serve it with, or does she just...
Oh, I mean, we pretend we eat it with things. But really, it's just plat.
It's just pure plat.
Ollie thinks he found plat nirvana because he opened up the pastry and put a layer of pâté inside.
That is hideous.
Then closed it back up again. Anyway, so I had 5 days of plat, and also...
Was it as good as Nanny Pat's, though? That's the question. God rest her soul.
I know. I bet it was better. Sorry, Nanny Pat. And my mum has turned into... I don't know if it's quite right to call her a missionary, but she's a woman with a mission, and that is to get the seawall trimmed properly. We went on a walk because my parents have a cottage by the sea, and absolutely every person we had to stop and lobby them to sign this petition.
Oh my God.
And she was firing off emails to this man called Russell. And I think it's really apt this has happened when she turned 70, because this is clearly her next epoch.
It's her new baby.
It's mission time.
Yeah.
And she's emptiness
syndrome.
She's always emailing Russell with just two fingers tapping away on her iPad. She sent Russell 5 emails, and the fifth was said something like, I don't know what her email said, but Russell finally replied saying, you know, dear Nikki, like, we're looking into this and we've had so much other foliage to trim away, you know, you wouldn't even believe. And then she obviously put in a joke. She said, I find your comment about me obviously always being on holiday completely unnecessary and unfounded. Anyway, Mum had a fresh email up ready to reply. And my sister was like, and like a sort of cheeky smile on her face. My sister was like, just leave it now. I was like, Mum, you're going to be into harassment territory. But anyway, I said to her,
mother like daughter, I can see where you get the terrier gene from.
Well, I said to her, I was like, because we were stopping everyone to talk to them, and she was going, oh, my daughter who's
that must have been a very long walk.
My daughter who's a fashion journalist says, and I was like, my God, I'm getting the full intro.
Anyway, I was going to say, did she try to tap you up for your Instagram following?
No, she doesn't.
We should say, Nikki, if you're listening, we'll put the link to the petition in the description of this episode.
But she said, I said, Mum, you're in danger of becoming a mad old woman. And she said, I don't mind, because mad old women mad old women get things done.
They get shit done.
Because everyone wants to get rid of us. Anyway, this became her mantra. And I heard her on the telephone to various bodies and sort of going into various huts to try and speak to various officials. And I heard her going, and you know what I said to my daughter? And I'm like, yeah, mad old women get things done.
It's true, though. They'll be like, you know that woman that keeps coming in and blithering on about the wall? Just do anything she asks.
Anyway, so that was quite comical. And then I went to Italy for 4 days. I went to staying in a village next to Cinque Terre, which is on the Italian Riviera. It was just gorgeous. You'd love it, actually. Lovely, pretty buildings, so much pasta and pizza. And
every meal, you said?
Every single meal, yes. Yeah, sausage plat, pasta, pizza. I think maybe
you must
like,
have been very bunged up.
I mean, completely, yes, if anyone's interested. Digestion is still sluggish. But I found it really interesting, actually, because, and I'm not really surprised, because Italy is very traditional, very, you know, Catholic mm-hmm. and sort of family orientated and probably not particularly advanced in terms of gender neutrality. But we were sitting down for dinner and I got, and Ollie got given a normal menu with prices and I got given a menu without the prices. And I was like, look at that.
Oh my God.
Look at that. And he was like, oh my
because
God.
They think that you're the fancy bit of skirt who doesn't pay for anything.
This was my point. And yeah. I was like, and he said, it would be ridiculous. You've just, you know, you've just, they haven't done that on purpose. And then we went to another ruinously expensive restaurant. You know, the one restaurant that costs more than all other 11 meals you've had in the vicinity. And they did it again. And I was like, in your face. So in front of them, I made him swap.
I would have said, can I have a menu with the price?
But it was then ruined by the fact that I hadn't bought my wallet with him, so he then paid. And it looked, I was like, fuck, it looks like instead I'm just really obsessed with his money. Anyway, so I did that. And I did so much reading. Sorry to rub it in, because I know you've been doing your rewrites, but I've read, I think, 8 books in the last 2 weeks.
I'm so jealous.
Which has been utterly
I think I've
joyful.
Lost the ability to read. I can't remember the last time I read a book.
Oh, I'll help you. I'll coach you back.
Thank you.
But you just found me on a street corner in the non-proverbial...
Looking like a little street urchin.
Reading, what's the actual title? The Course of Love by Alan de Botton, which is just absolutely lovely sort of modern philosophy book about a relationship. Very easy to read. Absolutely loved that. Came out last year. And I have, what did I read? Oh, I read Hunger by Roxane Gay, which was really interesting. It is all about, so she's obviously a famous journalist, Roxane Gay. She's written other brilliant books I've enjoyed called Bad Feminist, Difficult Women. And this book is about being a very overweight woman, and you know, her life as a woman that takes up a lot of space. And it all stemmed from when she was raped as a teenager, which I didn't know before I read the book. And about how she tried to cloak herself, you know, for security and for safety. So it's a very, very truthful, honest book. But it was, do you know what, it's an interesting one. I didn't love it.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know. I just didn't love it as much as her other books.
Maybe you clicked with the subjects on the other, you know, maybe they resonated.
No, but I
more.
Thought there's something interesting there that, do you feel, because I feel like when someone has written a very personal, I felt like this when I admitted I didn't love Ariel Levy's book, that I preferred her other writing. And one journalist friend of ours was like, I don't even want to hear. But there's something about a memoir where you automatically like
I felt immediately sick when you said that.
Oh, what? Cause,
because I'm writing a memoir.
Try and remove yourself from this.
Go on, tell me why you're going to hate my book.
No, I'm not going to hate your book. But what I mean is that when it's... No, you're going to... This has nothing to do with the memoir as a genre. Yeah. But when someone writes a memoir and you don't like it, I feel like you're not allowed to say because it's something very personal. And the subject matter is always... So with Ariel Levy, it was quite distressing subject matter with Roxane Gay's book, very distressing.
Yeah.
But I feel like if you say you don't like it, you're somehow being like a callous bitch.
Or criticising their life.
Their
indeed,
life.
Which
criticizing,
you're not.
Criticising no. their life experience. So I found that quite interesting, not enjoying it as much as her other work and somehow feeling guilty. And like
no.
I couldn't vocalise that.
No.
So that was Hunger. I read Commonwealth.
But you do have to love mine. That's the only...
Oh, I will love yours. You know I love yours. I read Commonwealth by Anne Patchett. Have you read any Anne
Patchett?
Oh,
no, I haven't.
I'd never heard of her. And my sister was like, oh, my God, have you not heard of her? You will absolutely love her. And funnily enough, she had done the kind of front quotation on Roxane Gay's book. So she's obviously...
Oh, okay.
It was a bit like when I discovered Meg Wurlitzer, another modern American author, female author, and I was like, where on earth have I been? So I've just bought all of Ann Patchett's books, and I read a brilliant book called Gather the Daughters. It's a debut book from Jenny Melamed, who is an American psychiatric nurse, and it's basically being dubbed the new Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing.
Fiction.
You love that. Yes. Yeah, dystopian. A loss of women's rights, sort of that. And then I read a book which had the most amazing reviews ever, but I thought it was the most boring thing I've ever read. And do you ever do that way? You're just fascinated that somehow it's been shortlisted for a Man Booker Prize and you are bored to fucking tears. I just couldn't see. It's called Hot Milk. And actually I tweeted, oh my God, did anyone else find this the worst book I've ever read? And three people tweeted back being like, this was the dullest book I've ever read. Could not.
I really like that you're really honest about that stuff. I still feel nervous when I'm in a group and I tell them I think Boyhood was the most boring film ever made. Also, do you know what else I think is boring? Casablanca.
I've never watched it.
It's boring.
Okay, I'll watch it. Isn't it meant to be boring, though?
No, it's meant to be like the seminal best film of all time.
But isn't it meant to be like Gone with the Wind?
Charlie hasn't watched it.
Gone with the Wind is also meant to be quite boring.
Gone with the Wind is amazing.
I've seen it. What am I talking about?
Gone with the Wind is incredible.
Yes, he's a nasty man. Red.
I fell asleep in Casablanca. Anyway.
Casablanca.
Oh dear.
And then last for my culture binge, I watched To the Bone, the Netflix only film starring Lily Collins about 21 year old girl who has long suffered from anorexia. And there's been a lot of opinion pieces about it, debating whether or not it's gratuitous and triggering, or a genuinely, what's it called? A genuinely
insightful,
helpful,
yeah,
thing to have in the forum. You haven't watched it, have you?
No, I have to say, as I've talked about before on the podcast, I have my own personal experience with the eating difficulties in the past, and I watched the trailer and I just found it, to use the parlance of our generation, I just found it too triggering. I found it very disturbing and upsetting. And I did find the kind of the Hollywood sheen on it and the peppy soundtrack and everything. I was just like, I'm not going to be able to handle watching this. I'm going to find it too difficult. But I have read a lot of commentary around it because I was really interested. And I must say that the overriding party line that I've found is that it does glamorise eating disorders and it is dangerous.
So having watched it, and obviously I can't really, this won't be a balanced conversation in that you haven't
I can't give an opinion because I haven't seen it
and you have experienced disordered eating yourself. I have seen it and I haven't ever had disordered eating, so this is going to be very much my, you know,
no, I'm very interested what you thought.
Which is in the same way that The Fault in Our Stars, which is about teenagers with cancer, I have a sort of mixed opinion of this idea of triggers and whether or not that invalidates the necessity to have something. So the fact that it was a trigger for you is completely understandable, and the fact that you wouldn't want to watch it because of your own experience makes more sense than nonsense to me.
Yeah.
But I don't think that means that it shouldn't exist.
No, I agree.
And I think a lot of the arguments about it being triggering, like there's a scene where her little sister tests her to guess all the calories. She's like, go, 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 on her plate. So she's like, sweet potato, 300, meat chop, 210, or whatever.
And I think that is harmful. I think that is harmful.
I don't, because I think that it is an absolutely accurate portrayal of what would be going through a career anorexic's head.
It is. The only thing that I would say is that stuff was fodder for those websites that I used to go on to my shame.
But do you think it means that they shouldn't exist? Because you could say this about
I just think it's such an epidemic in young women. It's such an epidemic. I think we don't have enough distance.
But is obesity. Does that mean that we shouldn't ever see hugely overweight women films? And should we never
see... But it's Lily Collins. It's like an...
Suffered from an eating disorder herself.
True, but I read an article. Again, I understand that I haven't watched it, but I read an article from a woman who suffered anorexia, and she said, look, my experience with eating disorders was shitting myself on the tube because I'd taken however many laxatives. It was not the thing I saw of a girl counting eating disorders. And the other thing is as well, it's like
yeah, she's thin, from what I've seen from pictures of her and from the trailer, but in the grand scheme of Hollywood, if we didn't know it was a film about anorexia, I don't know if we would think
no,
she's
would.
That thin.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. She looks really ill in it.
Okay.
You would. She's so gaunt, and you can see the fuzz on her arms. I don't know. I mean, again, I disagree with that. You see, she goes to a kind of safe house, and you see her talking about how she's never had sex before because, you know, this has ruled her pubescent years. You see a woman who desperately wanted to keep her baby but couldn't stop her. Purging, so suffered a miscarriage, and you see that, and it's bloody gory. I just think that we have to be careful with the idea of a trigger, that if something is triggering, by all means put your mental health first and don't engage
personally
with that.
Yeah.
But I just don't necessarily think that it should mean that these films aren't made, because I do believe that they help an understanding of the psychology of an issue a little more. And I also think that a lot of it is to do with PTSD. Like, watching that, there'll be a vast amount of post-traumatic stress disorder for you, because it would bring back all of those memories of that really harrowing time.
Mm.
And for a, this is a really crass comparison, but for a soldier watching a war film,
I am very similar to a soldier.
It would bring back, well, you were fighting a battle, just
yeah.
albeit of the personal kind.
Mm.
And that would bring back triggers and post-traumatic stress disorder. And I more think that we have to operate, we have to have the kind of agency as individuals to not engage with stuff that will be personally affecting to you.
I agree, and that can't censor. The only thing I would ask you, and I'm genuinely interested as someone who watched the whole thing, is the vibe that I got off it. Basically, it's fine to tell those stories, it's important to tell those stories, but those stories can't have a cool girl sheen. That the predominant message from those stories have to be the reality, and the reality is a hideous and dark and horrible thing. And if you think that balance was right, then...
Well, Anna Leskovich, who does the Seriously podcast, The New Statesman, and writes a lot of pop culture pieces for them, wrote one of the most interesting pieces I'd read on To The Bone, which you should Google, and it was I Watch To The Bone So You Don't Have To. And she talks about how it glamorizes anorexia, and it's a largely different position to how I felt about it.
Mm.
But she did say, and I can see this, that she felt like she was made to seem too much of a sort of badass. Although,
yes.
Again, I would say it's very clear that she has no friends. She gets back home and her stepmother's like, your dad doesn't want to see you. Like, what are you doing to us? How many more times do we have to do this? And her little sister bursts into tears and says, I haven't been allowed a childhood. All I've ever worried is about you dying.
Mm.
So I think, I mean, ultimately, I think this film was never, in the age of internet op-eds, this film was never going to escape criticism. But I think that the people that made it should be proud of making it. Much, to be honest, I found this much less problematic from an unbiased outsider's point of view than I did watching 13 Reasons Why. You know that film that Selena Gomez exec produced about a teenager who committed suicide?
No,
and
they, I don't actually.
It's it was a big Netflix thing last year, and
yeah,
there was a hoo-ha
yeah.
about it, because it was meant to be 13 Reasons Why She Committed Suicide.
Mm.
And the huge looming problem with that is that a lot of those reasons were, oh, she did it because this person screwed her over and this person dumped her and this person broke her heart. And teenagers or anyone don't commit suicide to get their own back. And the
no.
whole premise was that she had done this to teach them a lesson. And so immediately, there's a big old hole in it.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that with this.
And also that's extremely reductive as well on something very complicated.
Weirdly, I read less... There was less controversy about that than I feel like there is about To The Bone. Don't know. Anyways, so there you go. I've given you a whole bump of what I've been up to in the last few weeks.
I haven't done that at all.
Do you want to know what
I did? I lost my mind at a festival. That's what I did this weekend.
Is that the first time you've ever said that sentence?
Oh dear. Again, I lost my mind at a festival again.
Is there any of it PG commute?
Yes,
so. Bear in mind, people on their commute and you don't want to make them vom in their mouths.
So it was my friend Claire helps run this festival called Curious Arts Festival, which is kind of, there's music and there's authors and it's brilliant. I love it. I've been there before, and me and my mate Lauren went. And I think what triggered it was on the way down on the train, I said to her, I floated this theory that I said, I think we only do fun in a bit of a half-assed way these days. And she was like, I don't think we do. And then I gave her examples and I was like, I haven't got a problem with it. But I do think our like hunger for fun is diminishing a bit. And she said that she thinks that I lodged something in her head that she had to prove to me over the course of a weekend.
Did she get madder than you?
She went way madder than me, yeah. So we just completely lost our minds at this festival, got absolutely wrecked, booked this cab to get back to... take us back to our hotel at 1 a.m. And then Lauren came up to me at like 3 and was like, dude! And I was like, what? And she's like, the cab, it's gone! And we were in the middle of Hampshire. And she was like, well...
middle-class festival. Hampshire, hotel, like, taxi.
Oh, I can't camp anymore. My back can't deal with it. And she was like, well, we're just going to have to navigate through the fields. 2.5 hours in the darkness. 2 phones completely dead. With 2 people off their heads, singing Bruce Springsteen songs, holding hands. We finally get there. It's 5 in the morning at this point. And Lauren arrives at the front of the hotel and she says, oh dear, I left our key in that man's yurt. I'm sorry.
What did you do?
So then Lauren had to go to a payphone in the town, ring this emergency number for this man called Russ. Russ was like, it's under a pot plant. Lauren then goes and finds the pot plant, the key. Lauren finds the pot plant, smashes the pot plant. It's just...
what, at the hotel or back in the yurt?
At the hotel.
Oh, dear.
And then we get into bed at dawn. India said she thinks it sounded like an episode of Peep Show. And then the next day we were like, so hungover. I said, we cannot behave like this anymore. It's very undignified. And I said, I think we should go home. Well, the plan was we were going to go home that afternoon. I had to do an author interview with a woman called Nikki Hodgson about her amazing book about the history of dating. So I don't know how I managed to get myself onto the stage and do this like vaguely cohesive interview. And then we bumped into Cosmo Landisman and his girlfriend. And he was like, come and have lunch with us. Let's have a drink. 7 hours later, we realised we've missed the last train home and we had nowhere to stay.
Where did you stay?
In a man's tent that we found. So that is the name of that tune.
Well done, doll.
So there's been no book reading for me. Oh, I have been going to a lot of gigs.
Oh, well done. I haven't been to a gig since 1964.
Really?
Yeah, I don't really go to gigs.
Oh, because Aqua aren't playing anymore.
No, I want to go to Coldplay.
Do you know Coldplay are a band that only makes sense when you see them live?
They make sense to me, not live.
They're an amazing band to go see live.
What gigs have you gone? Those poor music lovers who listen to this podcast must be like, at last!
I went to Kurt Elling at the Barbican. He's a jazz singer, which was amazing. Although halfway through, I was with Lauren again. We're massive jazz fans. And halfway through, he was doing some proper hardcore scatting. He's like, and I was like, if any of our friends could see us now who hate jazz, which are most of our friends, they'd be like, this man, this white man in a suit singing skibbity bop boo, is why we hate jazz. But I loved it. And then I went to Tom Misch, who he would really like, actually. And I was there with my friend Sabrina, and a number one gripe that I have at gigs are people who film gigs. Because I'm like, you are never going to watch that. You are literally going to watch that. You're not going to lie in bed tonight, like, watching a tiny, fuzzy figure.
Yeah.
And also, it just, to me, shows, like, such greed of experience. They can't just, like,
The only time I understand people filming gigs are when they're at Glastonbury and the gig filming is an excuse to catch a celebrity fucked on screen.
Yeah, that's fine. I understand
that.
There
was a certain very famous celebrity caught in one of these videos recently at Glastonbury.
Oh, really? Can we talk about who? No.
No, but he definitely had enjoyed a little more than mulled wine.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Yes, that was very funny.
Very good video.
Yeah, but it really annoyed me. And it's when you can understand why Prince banned them from his gigs. It's when you just are seeing everything through a sea of screens and you just think you dickheads are not going
to
do anything with those videos.
Yeah,
it used to be lighters, exactly. It used to be something soulful. And my friend Sabrina, who I was with, is a terror for this. And she's half my height. And she kept going, Dolly, do you mind doing a video of this? And I was like, fine. And then it's like the fifth time she asked me. I was so annoyed. There was this man in front of me with just this quite gigantic bald head. And I just did a 1-minute video of his head bobbing around. I was like, that is a really good one. You're going to love that.
We had a very interesting email this week from a girl called Gina Martin. So I'm just going to read it to you.
Hello, Dolly and Pandora. I'm a big fan of the high-low, and to cut a long story short, I'm currently dealing with a situation where I'm trying to put as much pressure as possible on the police to charge two men who took upskirt photos of my privates at British summertime Hyde Park. My case has been closed because my quote-unquote genitals weren't on show. The picture showed my underwear and everything else, but it wasn't graphic. And because I was wearing underwear. I've since found out that there is a massive grey area when it comes to laws around this sort of thing. I posted about this on my Twitter account, at BeanieGGI, and it went viral, which helps my case as I'm also trying to put pressure on the government to change laws around upskirt photography. I started a petition with Change 2 yesterday. We will post the link for that on our Twitter and in the bio to this episode. And was wondering if you could share it on your Twitter, as the more my case is in the public interest, the more leverage I have to get them prosecuted. Thank you. I love both of you and your work, Gina.
It made me so angry, this. I'm so sorry this has happened to you, Gina. So far, the petition's been signed by over 22,000 people.
Amazing amount, because her aim, I think, is 25,000, but yeah. I say aim high. Beat that.
And also, it's like an experience that so many women face.
It's a really interesting one, upskirt. I hadn't really kind of thought about it that much until I was reading this. I didn't really know the law, the policy around it. It's a really interesting one from Gina. I also like how she just sounds very level-headed about it.
Yeah, she just wants to challenge the legislation.
Give her a lot of distress, but it's not an emotional email. It's let's change this, and how can I change this? And Gina writes, care to have spoken to victim support charities on my behalf and seen information from another police force that suggests I have been fobbed off by the Met. Upskirt photos can be a crime in the UK. In fact, a man was successfully prosecuted in 2009 for taking upskirt photos. The offence is outraging public decency. To commit an act of a lewd, obscene and disgusting nature which is capable of outraging public decency in a public place where at least two members of the public who were actually present at the time could have witnessed it. Gina says, please join me in calling on the Met to reopen my case and help me to get justice by prosecuting the men. If enough people sign the petition, we can show the police that they made a mistake letting this go. This happens to so many women constantly, and by putting pressure on the police to prosecute, we're aiming to urge the government and system to realise the reaction should not be based around what the victim is wearing, such as it would have been punishable if you weren't wearing underwear, but instead treated as a real and horrible assault that the police need to recognise as an offence every time it is reported. So yeah, we will tweet out that link so you can sign Gina's petition, and we will put it in the bio to this episode.
And we've said it a million times before, but women's bodies are not fucking public property, and we stand by you, Gina. Support for the high-low comes from our very elegant and beloved sponsor, NARS. This week, I'm particularly enamoured with the Bord de Plage bronzing and highlighting palette. The palette is four opalescent tones that work effortlessly with the skin to create a universal glow, as two light-diffusing bronzers add natural-looking warmth. Together, they create a second skin that amplifies and intensifies. They come in six shades, including golden bronzes and soft pink shimmers. It's got the new Sunwash Diffusing Bronzer in two shades in the palette, plus four highlighter shades, so you can really create lots of different looks with it. Perfect for holiday when you want to pack an edited makeup bag. They ring in at £45. NARS is offering high-low listeners two deluxe travel-sized freebies when they make a purchase online at narscosmetics.co.uk. Simply type in the code HILOW, H-I-L-O-W, at the checkout, and you will receive a mini Audacious Mascara and mini Velvet Matte Lip Pencil in Dolce Vita, one of their best-selling pinky nude shades, and incidentally, the one I have plastered on my pelt today. Thank you very much to NARS. I think it's time for the top line.
Why are you doing a German accent?
Oh, I thought it was more hello there. I thought it was trying to be French.
Don't you think that was French?
It was not French.
It's a bit more French.
That is more French.
I don't know where you're going now.
Okay.
So the top line is where we read out news from the last week in a buzzy, snappy format.
I can't even intro the top line. I can't do any intros. Why do you do this podcast with
anyway, we're just going to breeze over Dolly's existential crisis, intro crisis.
Hit the tunes, DJ Suchi. But I know I'll be hunting high and low.
High, hunting high and low. A vital piece of information to kick off the top line, and no, I am not being sarcastic. Kem and Amber won Love Island on Monday night, with Camilla and Jamie, Pandora's favourites, coming second. New ASA guidelines cracking down on gender stereotyping rule that advertisers can no longer mock men for not being able to do the laundry, or that doing the dishes is women's work. Cocaine production in Colombia reached record levels last year. The UN suggests that 866 tonnes of cocaine was produced in Colombia last year, in comparison to 649 tonnes in 2015. A Harvard faculty committee is petitioning to do away with frat houses. One day you might be able to watch a bro flick about an Ivy League university without students coming out of Pi Gamma Delta fuckface. The phrase Winnie the Pooh has been banned in China on the country's leading social media networks, such as WeChat, their version of WhatsApp, and Weibo, their Twitter, because of the bear's alleged similarity to China's president Xi Jinping. No, that is not an April Fool. In a public statement made on Monday, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, said, "I did not collude with Russia," adding, "I do not know of anyone else on the campaign who did so. My mum doesn't know who Jared Kushner is, incidentally. Quite envious of her for that." British photographer David Slater has been left broke after being sued by PETA. On a trip to Indonesia in 2011, David got a black macaque monkey to take a selfie grinning. It's an amazing picture, side note. Ooh. PETA are suing him for copyright infringement, claiming the rights belong to the monkey.
Oh my God.
A five-year-old girl was fined £150 by Camden Council for selling 50 cups of lemonade on the pavement. Enforcement officers turned up and told the little girl that she did not have a trading licence. Being aged five, she burst into tears. That was the top line.
We're hunting high and low.
I've done way worse things on the pavements of Camden.
God, how disgusting. What were your favourite bits there? I think it might have been Winnie the Pooh looking
I
like...
I love the Winnie the Pooh thing.
It's so good. How can that be true?
Also, can I just say, PETA, obviously they do very good work, but they're not helping the stereotype that vegetarians are the most humourless, earnest people.
They've left this man completely penniless.
Yeah,
this photographer,
that's insane.
It's the most amazing picture. I will be putting it on our Twitter. Seriously, it's like this monkey is just grinning, taking a selfie. It's all like teeth and sort of baboon face. But I'm also really, as someone who is absolutely fascinated by the fraternity and sorority systems that you see in Ivy League universities. And you know, for anyone that watches House of Cards and you wonder what that disgusting ring is that Frank Underwood, the president, wears, it's a like a signet ring from his frat house at Princeton. I think he went to Princeton. And it's a real, it's like so culty and completely bizarre. And you see it in stuff like Scream Queens, if anyone watched that had Ariana Grande in. I remember people were like temporarily obsessed with it last year. But like sororities and frat houses are completely insane in that sense. And on my gap year, I went travelling, and then when everyone else was getting fucked up in Thailand, I went to Yale and did some summer writing courses because I'm really cool. And on Friday nights, we go to a party in a frat house. And it was mad because they wouldn't drink during the week. And then you'd go to these parties and they'd all be topless, drinking out of those red cups, playing beer pong and throwing up in their shoe.
That's what Exeter was like. Truly, that's what Exeter was
but
like.
But you weren't a Pi Gamma Delta fuckface.
It was Exeter was like where fraternity culture and public school drinking culture intersected. So I'll let your imagination go wild.
Surprise, there's not a novel about that. Elizabeth Day, that might be your...
Yeah, that would be a great one for Elizabeth Day.
That might be your next one. Thanks to a government petition demanding that the BBC reveal the salaries of all their talent on more than 150,000, which is the Prime Minister's salary. Random, no idea why they demanded this petition. But anyway, the BBC laid bare how much Great British pound, they had paid the 96 talent who earn in excess of £150,000. So that's 96 people, and the results were incendiary. Highest paid was Chris Evans on 2.2 to 2.5 million.
Mind-blowing.
Next, Gary Lineker on 1.75 to 1.79 million.
Also mind-blowing.
Next, Graham Norton, 850k. Jeremy Vine, 700k. And then John Humphreys, Hugh Edwards, Steve Wright, then finally our first woman, Claudia Winkleman. I was on holiday when this came out, and I'd had my phone stolen, so I went old school and began reading the Daily Mail, the only paper in English at my Italian hotel, over breakfast, and it actually allowed me to indulge a guilty habit without shame. I just had a week of merrily flicking through the Daily Mail. And to say that the Mail went fulsome on their righteous indignation over the story is nothing short of an understatement.
Oh, I can imagine. My most shocking thing, other than the gender pay gap, was that Nick Knowles was on that list. Also, Chris Evans, I think, must have the hardest working agent in show business, because, like, famously, he gets these unbelievable deals. And I just don't know any Chris Evans fans.
Well, the BBC, I actually read that the BBC defended his particular salary, because obviously a lot of people are like, what the hell is he
doing?
His
salary is ludicrous.
Saying that he hosts, and I didn't know this because I don't listen to his show, he hosts the most popular radio show in Europe. So it's quite a big... When you think of it in that context, it might make sense why he is number one. It's
I still think that's a ludicrous amount.
It's a ludicrous amount, but it becomes less ludicrous that he's number one when you think about it in the context of Europe.
That is a thing that people forget as well. Helen Nianius always says this, that Radio 2 is the most listened to radio channel in this country.
Not just this country, though. He's got the most popular show in Europe, so that's got big. I was really thrown by this in lots of ways. Obviously, in the most obvious way, as you've already said, how few women are in, for example, the top 10, let alone the top 96, except for Claudia Winklepicker. Usual sexist financials there.
I was listening to Women's Hour the morning that the story broke and that these incomes were published, and there was this ongoing discussion throughout the programme about how one of the defences was that... The pay gap, the gender pay gap within the BBC is actually fractionally less than the national gender pay
is
gap.
Is it?
Yeah, but I think of all institutions, the BBC is public money and it is monitored with an implied morality.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
That doesn't quite wash with me, that argument, I don't think. Like, they should, of all places, they should be...
regulating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was quite baffled by how incensed people were by the actual salaries, because it's the entertainment industry. I don't really know why we're surprised. You can't view these figures in isolation. And if you're going to be so outraged, then sit down, grab a chair, because let's talk about the movie industry. Let's talk about, on the same day that this furore broke, there was a footballer whose name has temporarily escaped me, who was being bought by one football team for 156 million.
Mm.
You know, these, and that was on the back page of the sports section, nowhere near the front, nowhere near this kind of outrage. And I do get quite bored of that thing where anyone who earns over a certain amount of money is seen as disgusting and lazy. So, you know, when there are supermodels who clearly, like, get up at 3 a.m. every day, go do a shoot, have to smile and try and look sexy all day whilst, I don't know, having their period or whatever, like, I would fucking hate that job. And still people are like prostitutes who do nothing. You know, I get really bored of people not seeing the entertainment industry as a huge force of joy in almost all of our lives. However, I do think this is complicated by the fact that a lot of them tax dodge, which I fucking loathe. It's why I hate Philip Green with every fibre of my being. I don't hate him for being rich, and I wouldn't even hate him for the BHS pensions gate thing if he paid his taxes, but I think it's absolutely disgusting, and that it is taxpayers' money, and I sometimes wonder why it is actually funded by taxpayers' money and if it should still be funded by taxpayers' money, although I think there's no other way for it to remain supposedly unbiased.
If you start going into that question of why does someone who works in entertainment earn more money, why does a footballer more money, it is a really valid question, but it's a very big philosophical question, really, which is about shared wealth and the value, what work is valuable. In fact, I have just started reading Conversations with Friends, and one of the characters says in it that...
Do you like that book?
I'm only about 30 pages in, but
it's
I really like it.
It's had incredible reviews, but I was really disappointed.
I like it so far, but I'm only at the beginning. But there's this moment where a character says that she, please forgive me because I'm going to be using completely the wrong economic parlance here, but she said that she once looked up how much, if you were to divide the amount of money that is available in the world for people to be paid for their job, we would all average £16,000 each.
Well, I read this really interesting stat this morning in this book that Dolly and I were sent, which I have only read about 10 pages of but already love, and it's called How to Resist by Matthew Bolton. And in it, he says that by the first Wednesday morning in January, after the bankers have come back to work, the FTSE 100 executives in the city will have earned more money than we will earn in a year.
I do think it's an interesting conversation, but as you said, it's much further reaching than should Chris Evans be paid £2 million a year for his Radio 2 show. It's about who puts the value on work. Like, I remember saying to my friend Belle once, I was having to negotiate a fee for something, and Belle said to me, I think you should ask for X amount. And I said to her, well, I don't know if I'm confident enough that my talent, experience and product is worth that amount. And she was like, who decides what's worth that? She was like, do you think that bankers really think that the work that they do is valued at that amount? It's like such a strange system.
I think that value is literally what people will pay. So you can determine how much you or anyone is worth by how much they will pay. So if someone is on that on a salary, say that person is on that salary at the BBC, that is because a whole slew of people, from the BBC execs to the agents to the publicists to the individuals themselves, the producers,
have been willing.
Have all agreed that that is the value placed on. It is really a matter of philosophy.
Because it really
is. If you start
is.
Looking at it, you start looking at how many lives are affected and the quality of those lives and how much they have been enhanced by the person's body of work, by what they have produced. And then you start dividing happiness and mental well-being on a daily basis by overall enjoyment of life.
Someone who's really interesting talking about this is Sarah Jessica Parker on Alec Baldwin's podcast, Here's the Thing, and they talk about whether actors should be paid, successful actors should be paid the massive amounts of money that they are. And something that they both point out is that the entertainment industry, and acting in particular, isn't a system of meritocracy in a way that a lot of other professions are. So when you're an actor and you're out of work, which is the majority of most actors' life, you can be a waitress on minimum wage for however long, then you can get one big job and then you might fall out of favour and never get that job again. So something they point out is that, yes, it is more, the disparity is larger in terms of what the salaries are, but it's a much more unpredictable and random system of value and way of life.
I do see that as applicable, but I do think it's ironic coming from those two, because they are unlikely to ever be out of work and they will command millions of pounds for every role they do. The actors who have much more peripatetic work lives and might be out of work for a long period of time are not the actors that are being paid £50 million for a movie.
I think their argument is, coming back to what you said about the Victoria's Secret thing, is that they begrudge the idea that they don't know hard work or they don't understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I was reading an interview with Eleanor Tomlinson in Vanity Fair today. She's in pole dark, and she was saying for 6 months of the year as the leading lady on pole dark, she gets up at 4:30 in the morning. And I thought, fuck me, I would cry if I had to get up. I couldn't do it. I could not get up at 4:30 in the morning for six
me
months
either.
For love nor money. But I read a really interesting piece actually in The Independent titled Why Are Right-Wing Outlets Outraged at the BBC Salaries? It's Not Because of Gender Equality. And the piece says it's basically about privatisation, this whole furore, and that the BBC is just a vestige of 80s socialism. So basically other outlets are forced to use paywalls in order to make money, and by that I mean that the Sunday Times has to charge £10 a month for you to be able to read articles online, and the Telegraph premium charges money, and the New York Times pays £8 a month, and I know this because I'm somehow paying for all these fucking paywalls that I forget about. Whereas the BBC, being as it is funded by taxpayers' money, can afford to put up all the articles on their very good website that I look at every day for free. So there's actually the suggestion that what this comes down to is more a kind of the whole sort of Thatcherite privatisation versus socialist endeavour and ownership, which was not something I had.
No, that is very interesting.
Considered. I think the thing is, though, just coming back to what I said earlier, there is no point viewing this in isolation. So how much movie stars are being paid, as you said. And if you read down the whole list, and I got quite far, it's worth noting that a lot of EastEnders actors were on the list, including Lacey Turner, and they're all on £150,000. All the leading actors on EastEnders are on that same bracket. And they were really hard, and it's a leading soap, But doesn't the BBC political editor Kamal Ahmed, also on £150,000, work bloody hard? And then if you look at what other journalists, BBC aside, earn, it's considerably more. And in fact, a lot of leading journalists have pointed out that they earn less at the BBC than they would elsewhere, because it's considered a privilege to work there. And if you look at columnists and journalists at other publications that aren't funded by taxpayers' money, then you're looking at much higher salaries. There are famous columnists for newspapers who I know of, I can think of three, who earn £250,000 a year. Paul Dacre, the controversial editor of The Mail, took home £1.5 million last year.
Where on earth did you find that out?
Paul Dacre's salary is just on the internet.
Really?
Couldn't find John Witherow, who's the editor of The Times, and I couldn't find Kevin whatever it is at The Sun. I couldn't find anyone else's, but
Paul Dacre tweet us.
Paul Dacre is £1.5 million. So it comes back, I think, to that idea of the licence fee that the BBC demands we pay for, and some people struggle to pay for their licence, and that's where privatisation, I think, gets really difficult, because I think it's interesting to see this in the light of other journalists being paid a lot more. But if the whole taxpayers' money thing is to ensure that the BBC stays the one sole unbiased journalistic portal that we have left, I just don't even know if I think that exists anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if I think the BBC is unbiased. Anyway, you can go around in circles with this, but it does throw up a lot of interesting questions, and I think it's reductive and quite boring just to focus on, oh my God, they get paid so much money.
Also, I was very impressed that Chris Evans was the first to say it's completely right and proper that people should know this.
Oh, really?
He wasn't defensive about it. The strangest thing that I've read on the whole thing is Tom Chambers, who's a casualty actor, defended the gender pay gap within the BBC by saying a lot of male actors might have wives who are stay-at-home mothers and children, so that's why they should be paid more.
But you know why he said that? You've just reminded me of one of my favourite things I read, is he was defending, quote-unquote, the casualty actor Derek Thompson, who plays Charlie, who's been on the soap for 31 years.
Oh, my God.
And he earns £350,000. And people became rightfully obsessed with this because, I mean, who even watches Casualty anymore? But it's because when you've worked at a company for 31 years, like, yeah, they can't afford to fire you.
Support for this week's episode of The High-Low comes from Sainsbury's Home. Sainsbury's Home prides itself on delivering great quality, design-led products at very reasonable prices.
This summer, Sainsbury's Home has launched a sumptuous collection of home accessories, bedding and tableware in metallic colours and rich textures, inspired by traditional Moroccan designs and print.
I love a Moroccan textile. I've actually considered getting an EasyJet flight to Marrakesh simply to stock up on home furnishings.
I like your use of the singular there, a Moroccan textile. Well, look, Dolly, you don't have to do that anymore, because you can just go online or visit one of 400 Sainsbury's that stocks the Sainsbury's Home homeware. If you're a millennial with a love of luxurious velvet and touches of gold and marble, aka Dolly Hannah Alderton, this will be right up your street.
You could be in with a chance of winning a bundle of prizes from the range. Each week after the High-Low goes live, a Moroccan Lux... Do we call it Lux or Lux, Pandora?
I could go with Lux.
Lux. Moroccan Lux image will be posted on the at Sainsbury's Homes Instagram account, allowing you to enter up to four times.
Just follow at Sainsbury's Home, like the Moroccan Lux photo that mentions the High-Low, and leave a comment tagging a friend who you think would also like to enter the competition. The competition ends on the 28th of July.
And while I'm getting unbelievably stressed in my new flat, sorting out council tax and going on two-hour treasure hunts for the boiler, why are they always put in really weird places? I'm drawing on the Sainsbury's Home ethos, which is that it's the little things that make a house a home.
Thank you very much to Sainsbury's Home.
This is a pretty nutty story with a lot of bizarre details and some completely mad twists and turns, so buckle up and listen carefully. Journalist Jim DeRogatis, sorry if I'm saying that wrong, a former R. Kelly fan and interviewer, was tipped off over 17 years ago with an anonymous fax claiming that the star had been accused of sex crimes by underage women. The journalist went on to uncover a series of terrible allegations, which I'm sure we're all familiar with. The journalist has now led a BuzzFeed investigation into a new claim that R. Kelly enforces underage women to live in his house in a sex cult. Vox reports, Kelly, according to Cheryl Mack, Kitty Jones,
and Asante McGee, former members of Kelly's inner circle, controls everything from the women's use of phones to what they wear and what they eat. And the parents of these young women, unable to reach their daughters, are terrified about what is happening behind closed doors. The journalist told Vox, "The thing that makes me sick to my stomach is it's impossible in Chicago to walk three or four blocks in the music communities of the South and West Side and not find 10 people who have stories about R. Kelly, or their cousin has a story about him or their sister. Why on earth isn't there more reporting forwarding the story?"
I love that idea of three or four blocks in the music communities.
I know. He obviously really immersed himself in this story. To kind of find all this stuff
out. I was a bit late to this story because I was away and only reading the Daily Mail without my phone. But fucking hell, it's weird.
It's really weird.
I knew R. Kelly was a pedo, and I do believe I said on this very podcast that R. Kelly was a pedo.
It was still a bit muddled. Should we remind ourselves of that epic moment, listeners? India said, "Whatever happened to the Lighthouse family?" And I said, "I don't know, it's a crime."
Well, you know what happened to the Lighthouse family.
What did happen to the Lighthouse family?
A pervert.
What?
The main guy, what's he called? The
Tundi.
Singer? R. Kelly.
Oh my God.
That's what happened
R.
to the Lighthouse
Kelly
family.
Was not in the Lighthouse family, Pandora.
What was he in?
R. Kelly was just a solo artist.
R. Kelly was in the Lighthouse family. Is he definitely not? 100%.
This is my favourite episode of the ILO. Do you know who the Lighthouse family are?
I thought it was R. Kelly and friends.
When that day arrives, we'll live on ocean drive.
Never going to live that one down. I did say my musical knowledge was scant and I last went to a music concert in 1789. Anyway, the responses to this, as often the case, God, I love the internet because you can really canvas for opinion, have been really enlightening. So lots of people have been saying that, you know, the way that this is being reported is actually inaccurate because this isn't a cult, it's sex trafficking. Straight up, sex trafficking.
Yeah, that's true.
And some people have been defending Kelly, saying that these women are above the age of consent, they are all sentient beings. But I think it's more complicated than that. And side note, oh my God, can you believe, I had no idea about this, that he married Aaliyah when she was 15 and he was 28. And there are rumours that she had a child by him as well.
Really?
I fell down a Google spiral, obviously.
Oh, mate, me too. I think the most worrying thing that I've read on this subject is that he has apparently hired Monique Presley, who was the lawyer who represented Bill Cosby and who was a very outspoken supporter and defender of Bill Cosby.
Have you heard her statement on it as well? She's like, "This is a really hardworking, kind, compassionate man. Like, it saddens me and it saddens Rob that some people just want to tear this God-fearing man down." Like, it's the most hilarious statement.
But I think the thing that's worrying is the cases are similar in that it's a man of great power, and I think you know that Monica Presley is going to go down the same party line as she did with Bill Cosby, which was, well, if it was so terrible, why didn't you report it at the time? Which is like, all feeds into the problem of rape
victim
culture.
Victim blaming.
Yeah, and Jim DeRogatis, I'm sorry if I keep saying this name wrong, he himself said, "Look up the FBI statistics for sexual assault. This is rape culture. So many women are reluctant to come forward because they know what the process of getting justice is like. The number of women who actually file is a fraction of the number of women who are assaulted. For those who file, the number of arrests is a small fraction of those who filed. And something like 90% of sexual assault arrests, according to the FBI, never see a conviction." He also goes on to say, "I've said it often, and I'm paraphrasing Malcolm X by way of Mark Antony Neal, a great African-American scholar. Nobody matters less in society than young black women." What Neal has said is, if it was one white girl from the suburbs, this might have been a different story.
I mean, to sidestep, but an interesting maybe comparison that I said to my mum the other day was that if Madeleine McCann wasn't white, her
and
case,
angelic and with two doctor parents,
her case would not still be in the public eye. Yeah, there's quite a lot of pieces that have been written actually about how this is about race and that it's another example of black women being exploited by black men in positions of authority. Bill Cosby obviously is the major comparison that people have been drawing. There's an article on Vox.com by Feminista Jones, obviously a pseudonym, entitled "Black Women Have Been Calling Out R. Kelly for Years." And it says, "It's hard for me to believe that if the victims were young white girls, there would be the same reaction.
And she cites missing white girl syndrome. It's a piss poor excuse and further dehumanises black people and our lives by erasing our experiences from public knowledge. Missing white children are still afforded their innocence and deemed damsels in distress, whilst black girls are less innocent and pegged as runaway prostitutes, drug abusers or some other description meant to demean them and strip them of humanity and innocence. Just search missing girl on Google Images and you will see pictures of white women only. When men are suspected of preying on women of colour, the victims and their parents are often blamed first. In the past few days, I've witnessed a lot of this sentiment on Twitter and Facebook regarding R. Kelly's victims, and I read a lot of comments blaming the parents for not keeping hold of their daughters. Some say that with all of the allegations against Kelly in the past, parents shouldn't let their children go around him. I wish I could say I am surprised by this reaction, but I am not.
Yeah, it's very disturbing, and it's something I'm much more aware of since we had Rennie Edo-Lodge come on the show and since
Absolutely.
We read her amazing book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. It's really opened my eyes to systemic racism everywhere, at every turn, and how we value a white life over a black life.
Yes, culturally, agreed.
The most bizarre detail of the whole hideous thing I read in a Jezebel article, and I am just going to quote it now for you because it's extraordinary. One woman called Kim, who was in their inner circles, come forward and gave an account of how he punished one of the girls in the circle. Kim said that she and the girl were instructed by Kelly to take off your clothes and act like you miss each other. He got out his iPad and started filming, she said, but was dissatisfied by the 19-year-old's performance. He told Kim to sit on the couch and took the 19-year-old into another room. 20 minutes later, he called Kim in. Kim knocked in the proper way. Apparently, he had this like, very specific rule in which how the women were allowed to knock on their door, on his door. Then walked in to find the younger girl nude, except for one of Kelly's bigger pieces of jewellery, a heavy chain. He had his iPad recording and she was naked except for a big chain and she was running laps from one end of the room to the other, Kim remembers. She was running laps around the room and apologising. I have to act like I miss you more, she said. I wasn't getting into it. Panda and I were at an event last night and I told her this across the table and how extraordinary I found this detail. And I said, you have to hand it to him. He's a depraved pervert, but that is an incredibly imaginative perversion. And Panda reminded me that perverts can be creative too. It's not just the job of writers.
Perverts are many things, Dolly, as this story elaborates.
I went into a bit of a Wikipedia black hole on R. Kelly afterwards. And obviously this is no excuse for his monstrous behaviour, but interestingly, he was abused as a child and his early life sounds pretty traumatic.
Well, sex perpetrators have often been sexually abused themselves. It's a distressing cycle of abuse and it can be historic and it can be inherited and behaviour can be replicated. Can be, I add, I'm absolutely not suggesting that everyone who is a victim of abuse goes on to be an abuser, but the theory of cyclical inherited behaviour is definitely playing out in the case of R. Kelly.
Of course, the priority now is just the safety and the welfare of those young women, and I hope those girls get out, and I obviously hope he's punished appropriately. I did see quite a few tweets of people bemoaning how they can no longer enjoy the Ignition remix. Because of this story.
Oh my God, I've got the lyrics in my head as you said that. I'm not going to break into songs. That's not how to end this segment.
But I was just like, guys, a bit of perspective. Like, this is not the most disturbing thing of the story, is it?
You've got to love Twitter for that, though.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's now time for Ask the Hilo.
Thank you for all your emails. We had a bunch in the last fortnight and we've loved reading all of them. You can always email us with your feedback, comments,
questions, inquiries, suggestions,
dilemmas. We're thehiloshow@gmail.com.
You can also tweet us at @thehiloshow. Kicking off with a question. Dear Dolly and Pandora, let's not beat around the proverbial here. The Hilo is the best podcast of its kind in the podcastosphere.
don't know how to say that. I'm 24 years old and I have never had anything that could come remotely close to a boyfriend. I'm painfully insecure about this and really concerned there's something wrong with me. I've had sex 2 times over intense insecurities about still being a virgin, but safe to say, both times were not pleasurable in the slightest. I feel incompatible with romantic and sexual love, like it's just not meant for me and I'm incapable of attracting it or giving it. I'm a natural introvert, but since moving to New York a few months ago, not knowing anyone for a new job, I've gone out, I've taken risks, and I've used apps, all to try and be really proactive. I must stress, I'm incredibly fortunate to have a surplus of love in my life, and I am also extremely independent, but I desperately and deeply crave a relationship. Love, Anon. Really interesting one, this.
It's a dichotomy I know really well, that feeling of, I don't know if this is something
wrong with me.
In that there's a pull between having this life that's abundant with love, not romantic love, and enjoying your independence, but also having this quieter voice that says, why can't you do relationships? Is there something wrong with you? Do you need to have one? First of all, the thing that I really want to make clear is that no one is going to have a good shag on their first 2 one-night stands. That's completely normal. I would have been astounded if you said, and he was Mr. Lover-Lover and it was the best sex of my life. Like,
yeah, that's an interesting point to make, because when I first read this, I was thinking, oh, I wonder if she's asexual. And, you know, that there is a percentage of society that are not sexually motivated, and maybe that's just something to how she feels. But that's a really interesting point you make, is you're not going to feel sexually motivated when you've had two terrible shags.
No, and this is the thing that I think
it's like riding a bicycle as well.
This is the thing that people misunderstand. If you are someone who's had 100 one-night stands, those are not the people that are the most sexually knowledgeable. You learn about how to have good sex and you learn about intimacy when you're in a relationship. So don't worry that these two frissons that you have had have not been good. It's not indicative of what sex will be like for you in the future. Sex just gets better as you get older anyway. The thing that I just want to hammer home on this is, you mention that you love your independence and you have an abundance of love in your life. We place such a premium on romantic love in our society. I think sometimes we maybe obsess over it or think that we want it when we don't. And like, maybe your life is really full. Like, maybe you're at a point where you hang out with your friends all the time and you're starting your career and you've got loads and loads of passions and hobbies. Like, maybe you haven't got room to pursue that.
Well, to quote the great Hannah Dolly Alderton, the biggest loves of my lives are my female friends.
For sure. Don't punish yourself if that is the case. And in time, you'll find space for it. And maybe you won't. Like, that's fine as well.
What she doesn't say, which I'm interested in, is you don't say if you fancy many people. So it's hard to determine.
She did actually. In her longer letter, she said she's only really fancied 4 people. But she said one of them ended up getting with her friend and the other 3 looked straight past her. Which, my God, I know that feeling, don't worry.
Yeah, interesting. I think it's a really difficult one with that sort of knowing you and more about your situation. Because whilst, as I was saying, that I thought whilst reading it earlier, whilst I would hate to suggest that you are asexual if you just haven't been in a time of your life where you're ready for a relationship or met someone that inspires that feeling in you. I also think that there is many more people, an unspoken part of society for whom sex is just not
a priority.
It's just not a motivation. They will never get that impulse, and therefore a lot of them are not in relationships. And if they are, they are in relationships where, you know, they might not even kiss. Certainly there'd be no sexual contact. Again, to stress, I'm not saying this is what your letter's saying, but I do think that we have to remember that in the same way identity is this vast spectrum, and, you know, sexuality is this vast spectrum, so is, you know, sexual inclination. You know, you might know someone who has sex every single day, God help their chafed private parts, and then you might know someone else who's, you know, likes having sex once a month, and then there might be people who haven't had sex for 20 years and they're fucking thrilled about it. So it's hard, especially for you, age 24
thing.
In a new city, it's really difficult, for, as you say, to work out if there is quote unquote something wrong with you, or and just to, you know, clarify, there's nothing wrong with you, there's just different people, different shades for different, what's the bloody cliche?
Different strokes for different folks.
That's it.
There we
different
are.
Different strokes for different folks.
Maybe she doesn't want to be stroked.
Maybe you don't want to be stroked. Anyway, we could go on.
I think she does. I think she does want to be stroked.
I think you want to be stroked too.
But I think
so. Why not stroke yourself until you?
Fall? We're not going down this path.
Self love.
The Hitachi wand.
Sorry, Mum.
The parting thought I would give is don't do fucking anything because
don't do fucking. That's your parting.
No, that would never be my parting thought. Don't do anything because you feel like you're disappointing people or you're weird or you need to prove something to the world. Only do something. It might just be that you haven't met a really amazing person.
You haven't met your panty dropper.
And exactly. And maybe you'll meet him. You'll meet the panty dropper and you'll be like, everything has fallen into place. But don't go out on aggressive dating and searching for something if you're worried that something is wrong with you. Just like listen to your own instincts.
Also, can I just add that for an ingenue in love, in the art of love, the New York dating scene will eat you alive.
Fuck me.
So please settle in gradually to New York. Yeah. Maybe do one app, but bear in mind that career dating means you date about 8 different people and you're not exclusive with anyone, and that might ensure that you never dare have sex ever again.
You'll never find the panty dropper at that rate.
Good luck. Keep us posted.
Second question. Hi, Dolly and Pandora. I've been having trouble recently with one of my best friends and I need some advice. I love her to bits, but recently her insecurities have been starting to play on me. She's an incredibly attractive girl and receives a lot of attention around her appearance. However, she is also very insecure with her appearance, which I'm sympathetic about. It's something we all experience, but it's got to the point where she needs constant reassurance. Everyone needs lifting up once in a while, and it's my job as a friend to do that. But it's become almost draining to provide that constant reassurance. I've said it 1,000 times, I'm exhausted. I don't know whether to distance myself from her because it's affecting my mental well-being, or if that's a selfish thing of me to do. Should I help her become more confident?
This is really interesting because I think most women will have experienced this.
Definitely.
I have experienced this from being very low about 7 years ago and knowing that I was overburdening my friends emotionally and then putting up walls and it really actually breaking me. And I can remember two friends who I felt like were not there for me at that specific time, and it really did lodge in my memory. And I try and remind myself of that when someone asks reassurance for the nth time. It also reminded me, and bear with me, of an episode recently of Love Island where Montana said, rather bitchily I thought, that Camilla needed constant reassurance and she found it emotionally exhausting, and why couldn't Camilla just sort of buck the fuck up and enjoy herself? And I really empathised with that, but I also did have a flicker of, God, it's sort of fair enough that Montana's a bit bored of it, isn't it? It's sort of fair enough that sometimes you feel like, I've said this a million times, you know, if you're not going to listen to me, what's the point in saying it anymore? And the thing you have to hope is that it's a phase, because most women ebb and flow in terms of their confidence and their self-esteem. If this is a problem you've been having with her for years, then I would say she probably needs to go and talk to someone.
Yeah, that's my advice. I think the thing is, it's like, people think we're given such a picture of friendship being this like easy breezy thing, but you know, it's like a marriage, it's like a relationship, it's hard work, and you do enter into a contract when you have a best friend that but you do put up with their bullshit.
We need to update our contract for this.
And you and you've fulfilled all your obligations in your friendship contract with us, by the way. And you do have, if you're going to abandon her in this hour of need, who else does she have? Do you know what I mean? I just think, like, however stressful it might be for you to have to reassure her, imagine how much more stressful and exhausting it is to be in her poor little head. And the thing that I would say is you need to have a moment of, like, well done for being so patient. Draw on your deepest resources of compassion and know that hopefully she will do the same for you in a different way in the future, and sit her down and say, my darling girl, I just feel like we've got to a point where there are not enough compliments in the world from anyone that will make you feel full or make you feel happy with yourself, and I can't supply you with that anymore because I just feel like it's empty for you and I want to help you. So
maybe you need to work on where you can get that sense of self-worth, because it ain't going to be a compliment from me. Maybe you should go talk to someone professional about this.
Very well said. There was an interesting line actually in your letter that I did think about, where you said it's affecting my mental well-being. And that is more of an alarm bell, because I would say a lot of the time when you have a friend that might be being a bit angsty and annoying, it doesn't affect your mental well-being. It affects your patience.
And your time.
If it's genuinely affecting your mental well-being, then I think that's interesting. And I think you need to sit down and figure out why it's affecting your mental well-being. Is her lack of self-esteem making you doubt your own esteem? And if so, you need to evaluate the support network you have around you.
Exactly.
Because I think in order to be there for other friends, you have to draw on other friends, and that's the way friendships work. You're all drawing on different people for different things. But I remember, and keeping it quite opaque, about 6 months ago, you had a situation where you had a friend in need and you didn't have the time or the words to soothe that person. Do you have any practical tips for her? Because I feel like you're in a very similar situation to this girl.
The problem is that you do have to... Your presence has to be there, and you have to be concise with your support and your kind of unconditional love. But you also have to, as Pandora says, you have to preserve your resources and you have to help them move forward. And it got to a point with a friend where I just said, I am all out here. I think it's the blind leading the blind a bit. This is such a huge problem. I'm saying these platitudes over and over. I'm trying to give you this advice. I don't think that I'm helping you move forward, and I really want to help you move forward with this situation. I think you need to talk to a professional. And I helped her find a professional. She went to talk to the professional. Things got much easier. And I said to her, you know, I am always here as well to talk to you and to give advice, but I think this might be greater than me, and I want to be productive with this problem.
And also, as a friend, I would say that the friend should be there as the emotional backup, not the emotional anchor.
Yes. It's no one's entire job. You know, I said earlier, you have a contract. What I meant is we have to put up with our friendship. We have to be loyal to a certain extent, because who else will? But it's no one's, in romantic life, in family life, anything, it's no one's responsibility ever to be the sole provider of another person's happiness or mental well-being. And you mustn't ever feel the weight of that responsibility.
Absolutely.
And no one should put that on you.
Again, please do keep in touch. Let us know how you get on with your friendship and with yourself.
And as always, if listeners are listening and this particularly resonates with them, or they've had a similar experience, or they've come out the other side, do email us some advice and we can put you guys in contact.
Yeah, we're always forwarding emails that other people have suggested from other ideas. And in fact, we had a really lovely email back from a listener who was suffering from anxiety a few years after her mother died and didn't want her name read out because there were people in her life that would worry. And she said, you know, thanks to the responses that you forwarded me, and it made me think, and I'm now seeking professional help. And I think she said she
opened up to people in
her
life.
Yeah, and I think she said she was feeling a lot better.
Yeah.
Which is great. Our third email is a bit of an unusual one, in that we've never had a question like this in the high-low inbox. So I'm sure it will be a problem, not necessarily of this scale, but I'm sure it'll be a problem for lots of others as well. I found it really affecting and really sad, probably because I'm lucky to enjoy a very strong relationship with my mother, and I've actually been thinking about it all day. Anyway, here goes. Dear Dolly and Pandora, my sisters and I are fed up of having to deal with our emotionally volatile, manipulative and unempathetic mum. It's led to years of family fighting, though we cover it up pretending to be happy on the outside. I challenged mum on this behaviour last summer and it was a complete flop. She refused to see any wrong in how she acts. She now holds a grudge against me, there's minimum contact and her behaviour has got even worse. I convinced her to go to see a family therapist with me, but the session was so painful. She sat there stone-faced and denied anything that I or the psychologist said. Since then, my sisters and I have been trying to move on with our lives and support each other as best we can. What concerns me now is that my niece, who is not yet 12, is getting the brunt of mum's behaviour. She's being told she's fat, she's being put under pressure to be more creative, she's being told that her own mum is messy, lazy and poor. This is a girl who has already had a tough life. My sister had her when she was just 19 and her dad is a heroin addict. My sister relies on my mum hugely for childcare and she feels completely trapped. My niece is an amazing girl and I'm terrified that these great qualities will be picked away by my mum's throwaway nasty comments.
As you said, it's so difficult to have any proper insight in this because I'm in this very privileged position like you are, that I have a very good relationship with my mother, and I understand that's a very lucky thing to happen in life, particularly as I've grown up. I've noticed more and more with women that I know how they have these particularly dysfunctional relationships with their mothers. The only advice that I can give you is, first of all, I think it's two separate issues. The issue with the niece, I would just say she's so young, and as you said, she's gone through such trauma, and it's so dangerous for a young girl to be hearing that stuff about her physical appearance at that age. I think you need to just keep her out of your mother's life. I think you and your sisters sound like you are level-headed and grown up enough and sturdy enough now to have each other and deal with it. But I think just keep that your niece away from her if possible. The only point of comparison that I have is I had a friend whose mother was continually disappointing her. They had a very, very distressing relationship. Her mother behaved very badly. She felt very abandoned by her. And but my friend said, she's my mum. You know, I don't want to lose her completely. She's my family. I don't want to lose that connection, even though it would be easier to cut her out of my life. And I said, look, you just have to completely, you've tried so hard to make this work. They did the therapy thing as well. It just wasn't going anywhere. I was like, you just have to reconfigure in your head.
I was about to say, recalibrate the definition of a mother. Yeah. So for you and your sisters, she might be this distant, quite troubling presence. She's still your mum. You still see her on occasions, but she is not your emotional anchor.
No.
To come back to
no.
that. She's not someone you should rely on. She's not someone that she's you not should be vulnerable
you.
In front of.
Yeah.
Your niece is, I don't know anything about your financial arrangement, your sister's job, your jobs, where you live, the geography of this, anything. But as your niece is almost 12, so I'm guessing she's at school most days, can, being as close as you and your sisters are, or if any of you have partners or neighbourhood, you know, next door neighbours, can you arrange a system where you are not relying on your mum, because it doesn't seem like it's right for her to be in your lives at the moment. So are there, you know, can you talk to local support centres?
Yeah.
There must be, if your sister is really struggling for money, and because the child's father is a heroin addict, presumably she's not getting any child allowance from him, can the state offer any subsidised care? This is not an area I'm particularly familiar with, but I don't believe that your mum, with her maybe poisonous thoughts at the moment, I don't believe your mum can be the only childcare in your niece's life. So, you know, put your heads together, use other family members that aren't, you know, maybe it's the other side of your family, or that they don't have a relationship with your mum, you know, draw on other people. But also give yourself a bit of a rest. Don't do any more family therapy. Don't kind of try and knock this on the head.
It
don't
sounds
respond.
Like you've tried really hard.
Don't give her the luxury of knowing what she's doing to you. Disengage completely and emotionally, and treat her like you would treat a really difficult colleague at work. Be polite, be civil, reply, keep things brief. Do not ever go out of your way mentally, physically. Do anything you need to do. But, you know, the one thing that no one has control over, which I often have to remind myself, is no one has control of how you think. So you can say, yes, okay, thank you so much for your advice. And in your head, you're like, you're a fucking bitch, and I'm never going to listen to anything you're going to say. By the way, I don't have any of those relationships in my life. But I've certainly worked with people where I've been like, you are an awful person. You know, you think all the things you want, but for now, close up, shore up.
Set some boundaries.
Don't put any of that on the outside, and try and shield your niece from that as well. Best of luck.
I'm so sorry you're in that situation. We're sending you all our love and support.
Thank you so much to everyone who listened to the High Low today. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes.
It makes a real difference. It helps people find us more easily, and it gives us a big boost.
Yes, it boosts us up the chart. You can tweet us at The High Low Show. You can email us thehighlowshow@gmail.com, and we will be putting links to everything that we can remember, which is never everything, in the bio of this episode. So when you listen on iTunes, just read down the page, and we'll be trying to put lots on our Twitter as well. Thank you so much to Acast, our podcast platform, for letting us use your studio to record this episode.
Thank you to Lauren Benstead for the funky groovy music and for the adventure over the weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.